What's up, wrestling fans? Welcome to another episode of Not About Wrestling, the show where I talk to some of the biggest names in and out of the ring about everything except the actual wrestling part. My guest today is writer and TV producer Keith Elliott Greenberg. Greenberg is a New York Times bestselling author. He's co-authored biographies on some of the biggest names in wrestling history, including Ric Flair, superstar Billy Graham, and classy Freddie Blassie. His latest book, Too Sweet, Inside the Indie Wrestling Revolution, is out right now, and I recommend picking up a copy. Keith and I discuss his growing up as a wrestling fan in the Bronx, his early love of the sport thanks to a family who actually planned vacations around seeing live wrestling, how he broke into the wrestling writing for newspapers and then eventually WWF Magazine, his time working with Freddie Blassie and Billy Graham on their autobiographies, and his experience with Ric Flair, and some of the regrets that he has about, you know, their time working together. We also obviously talk about the future of indie wrestling after COVID. Also, Keith and I discuss his unpublished biography about the Iron Sheik. He actually wrote two versions, neither ever made it to press, but those who received an advanced copy of the second book called it the greatest unpublished treasure in wrestling journalism. So we get into all that, especially his experience working with the Sheik. Keith was just a great guy to talk to because he's seen firsthand the evolution of the business and actually how it's covered in the media, you know, for the past three decades. So without further ado, hailing from the Bronx, New York, here's Keith Elliott Greenberg. What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Not About Wrestling, the show where I talk to people in and out of professional wrestling about things other than professional wrestling, and then sometimes wrestling. With me today, best-selling wrestling author and true crime author, Keith Elliott Greenberg. Keith, how you doing, man?
Hey, Chris. Glad to be here.
We were just talking because you go by your middle name as a writer. I'm assuming that's because there's many different Keith Greenbergs.
There actually aren't too many Keith Greenbergs. Keith really? Is a Scottish name, and Greenberg obviously is a Jewish surname. So I've only met one other Keith Greenberg. It was Keith Henry Greenberg, okay, who lived a couple of neighborhoods away from me. Uh-huh. And I remember him telling me that when I was very young, I wrote for a local newspaper. And he said that his parents would say, look at this Keith Greenberg. He's writing it for the newspaper. And what are you doing?
How old
I was told he was a very good first baseman from a mutual friend.
Well, that's a trade-off. How old were you when you started writing for a newspaper?
I've been a professional writer, meaning I've been getting money to write since I've been 19 years old.
Wow. Did you know at a young age you wanted to be a writer? Is it just something you were naturally gifted
at? It kind of evolved. When I was in high school, I wanted to be a cartoonist. Mm-hmm. And I realized I graduated high school at 17 and started taking art classes. And I realized I didn't have the discipline to draw to draw anything other than cartoons to entertain my friends. Mm-hmm. But I was able to put a sentence together and, you know, put a story together, and hence I became a writer.
Did you take a lot of writing classes in school, or were you just kind of good at it?
I took writing classes in school, and I had some good teachers too. But I think that you really have to find it in yourself. You know, you can go to the Columbia School of Journalism, and then if you go to a trailer park and you're intimidated by the people there, or you go to a housing project and you're looking around for the exit, people are going to feel judged and they're not going to open up to you. And likewise, if you go into a wrestling dressing room and you're staring too much, the wrestlers are going to say, what are we, a carnival act? Even if they are or were back in the day.
Well, so let's go back to the beginning. We're going to talk about the whole writing about wrestling in a second, but let's go back to the beginning. When did you realize you were a wrestling fan?
As long as I remember, I was a wrestling fan, My grandparents were true believers. Mm-hmm. They were both from the former Soviet Union, and they watched wrestling and they believed what they saw. They thought they were real fights. Mm-hmm. And they would get very emotional about wrestling. And then my mother, that was on my father's side, my mother was an Antonina Rocca fan. Mm-hmm. I remember my father telling me about a wrestler named Man Mountain Dean, who I looked it up when I was being interviewed by Joel Gertner for his podcast. He wrestled in New York in the 30s. So my father has dementia now, he's 94. But I'm wondering if he might have seen Man Mountain Dean live. I need to remember to bring it up with him.
Wow.
You know, and my uncles were wrestling fans. My cousins were wrestling fans. So, you know, it was just an environment that I was always around.
Who were your favorites growing up?
Well, naturally, I'm 61. So Bruno Sammartino would have been my favorite locally. Mm-hmm. Because he was the everyman, he was the working man, he was the hero. And even though he was very muscular, he was also not the largest wrestler. Mm-hmm. So he was a bit of a giant killer. He'd have to rely on his strength to overcome adversity. And I also enjoyed Freddie Blassie quite a bit. And and it's interesting because later on in life, I ended up co-writing his autobiography. I think in my sixth grade autograph book, it was favorite athlete, and I think I wrote Freddie Blassie. I'm pretty sure I wrote Freddie Blassie. So, you know, and I enjoyed him for the fact that he was so colorful and so irascible. And there was something anti-hero in Freddie Blassie.
I feel like growing up, so I'm 43. When I was a kid, if you told people you were a wrestling fan, they kind of, you know, it was kind of laughed at a little bit, but at least kids that age got it. Like, how did kids react when you were a kid to being a wrestling fan?
That's a really good question. A lot of them reacted negatively. They didn't feel that wrestling was a real sport. They didn't understand the sacrifices that wrestlers, put themselves through in order to entertain. They didn't understand the pride in professional wrestling, and how these guys physically invested so much of themselves and gave away part of their lives by putting on these physical battles. And so a lot of times I was told it's fake and you're an idiot for liking it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that way, later on when I would interview wrestlers who were second generation, there was a modicum of relatability, because they had to defend the business because that was the family profession. In my case, I felt I was also defending my family because everybody in my family were wrestling fans. They were essentially saying, you're a basket of deplorables, to use a political term.
Did you ever go to an event altogether, like your whole family?
Yeah, and then later on when I was in around fifth grade, my uncle and aunt moved down to Florida. And then my grandparents would stay down there for periods of time. And so we would go down there, and sometimes we would even plan the family vacation that we would be there. We'd get there maybe on a Wednesday morning, and we would stay through the next Wednesday and leave on Thursday. And that way we could go to two weekly shows at Miami Beach Convention Center.
Wow. Do you remember who you saw there?
Yeah, I saw Buddy Colt over there. I saw Tim Mr. Wrestling Woods. I saw Eddie Graham and Mike Graham team together. I saw Pac Song. I saw Dusty Rhodes. I saw Jack Briscoe against Harley Race. I saw Bob Roop. You know, I saw a young Bob Orton Jr. The memories are starting to, you know, to come out.
Did you grow up reading the quote-unquote After Mags when you were
I certainly did. I certainly did. And I remember when I first met Bill Apter, when I was starting out, he called me back about something. And I was like, Bill Apter is calling me? And it's funny because during the Facebook era, there was some post I had put up, and Bill Apter was one of the people who, you know, posted a response, and a friend of mine just posted, Bill Apter, question mark, exclamation point.
It's funny what impresses us wrestling fans. So when you were reading those magazines as a kid, did you think to yourself, this is something I could maybe write about?
Well, not initially. Initially, I believed a lot of the stories that I read. Mm-hmm. And then as time went on, like I remember that the, I think it was Inside Wrestling would do these psychological profiles, usually of villains. Mm-hmm. So it'd be Freddie Blassie, you know, villain on the East Coast, hero on the West Coast. And they did one about the original Sheik, mm-hmm. and how the original Sheik, you know, when he was growing up in the, you know, sands of Arabia, he would fight until his opponent was dead. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking to myself at that point, is this just, you know, drama, or is that how he really grew up? But at the time, I had no idea he was the promoter in Detroit.
So would you think, do you say you were maybe exposed to that side of the business through the magazines before even the wrestling part, that, you know, it's a little bit of a work?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, I think there's a level of development that where you just start to figure things out. I can remember when my daughter was about 12, you know, at the, up until that point, she pretty much believed what she was watching. And then there was a, there was an angle between Randy Orton and Brock Lesnar, and suddenly the lights went out, and Randy Orton was in the ring, and he was giving the RKO to Brock Lesnar. And a light went off in her head, and she's like, wait a second, he's banned from the building. And he got into the building, snuck through everyone, no one noticed him. And when the lights were out, security didn't stop him. He got to the ring and he RKO'd Brock Lesnar, who's not an easy guy to RKO. And she said, Vince McMahon sent him out.
So she was onto it. My kids recently got into wrestling. They're big. They love the New Day, which makes absolute sense for kids. Yeah. And my daughter is obsessed with Sasha.
And she's a great performer.
Yeah, she is. And my daughter is 7. And I would say maybe the second or third time she watched it, she turned around to me and she's like, are they really fighting?
And I think that's a common question. And yeah. I think even when I was a kid, I would ask that question. And I remember when I was on retainer for the WWF's magazines, I went to a show in South Africa. And even people who were educated there, they hadn't seen pro wrestling in South Africa in quite a while. I think there were two promoters whose last name were Cohen. Mm-hmm. One was, I believe, the father of the Simpson brothers, who later wrestled in World Class. And there was another Cohn, K-O-H-N, I believe. And but they hadn't promoted there for at least 20 years. So the people I was meeting were, you know, recent WWE fans, maybe even people who were going to the shows with their kids. And so I'd be talking to fans in the audience and, you know, as I was circulating around, just getting a feel of the country through the prism of wrestling fans. And some fans would go, is this real? Like, are they really fighting? And it was kind of refreshing because, you know, I hadn't been asked that question, you know, since probably my teen years.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it has to do with, too, I mean, when you and I were watching, we were watching on these giant televisions, like giant tube televisions where you couldn't really see that much. Whereas now with high definition and all the camera angles, like it's kind of like magician's secrets are being revealed where you can kind of see, wait, why do they keep talking? Why does it keep, you know? So it's right, a little easier for the curtain to get pulled back.
HDTV made a big difference there. Yeah. Because you can only hide so much on HDTV.
Right.
And I believe that's when a lot of wrestlers began bringing their hands up to their mouths when they were communicating.
Right.
You know, and look, you know, if it you know, you could even back when I was growing up, if you went to a live show, there would be times when you could see somebody didn't connect with a punch.
Right.
You know, not everybody. And I remember I once asked my aunt whether it was real, and she said it's fake except when Bruno wrestles.
That's a great answer. So you mentioned that you eventually ended up writing for WWF magazine. How did that all happen?
I was writing about wrestling pretty early on, for regular publications, mainstream publications. And I was, because it was a subject I knew quite a bit about. And I was doing an article for Us Weekly at the first WrestleMania. And I ended up sitting next to the editor of the WWF magazine, Ed Ricciuti. And he was about 20 some odd years older than me. And he had led the freelancer's life. We had a lot in common. And he said, after a while, he said, I don't meet many wrestling writers who are that adept about other subjects. I think you could add a lot to the WWF magazine and what we're trying to do here. So why don't you do some articles for us, and then maybe we could put you on a monthly retainer, which he did. And I'm eternally grateful to him for it.
So you were way before the Vince Russo era of the magazine.
Yes, but I knew Vince Russo quite well, and mm-hmm. I would call Vince Russo a friend. And that has nothing to do with wrestling. It's just our interpersonal relationship when we were not talking about wrestling. That's mm-hmm. how the friendship was formed.
Mm-hmm. So you start writing for WWE Magazine. Is that how the books evolved? Like, you started writing the biographies?
Yeah, and I had always wanted to write a wrestling book. And I can even remember at one point very early on, before I was writing for the WWF Magazine, I wanted to do a book about Bruno Sammartino. And I had done an article about Bruno, and I actually began calling him regularly. And, at that point, he was very much a kayfabe guy. Mm-hmm. And he was griping. At that point, he was embittered towards the, he would go through periods. He was embittered towards the Bob Backlund era, WWF. Mm-hmm. And then he reconciled. His son got a job with the company, and he was, part of the announce team. So I entertained that notion of doing, the real story of who these men are, thought of these men. I didn't think of the women wrestlers at the time, although Fabulous Moolah and her troupe would have been a nice addition. And, so I'd always thought about doing a wrestling book, a long form pro wrestling project, which involved the real life stories mm-hmm. of the Titans of the Mat Wars. And, but through WWF, that was how I ended up doing the first biography, was the Freddie Blassie biography. Mm-hmm. And I was quite autobiography. And I was quite gratified because I was a Freddie Blassie fan. And I remember when the first wrestling books came out, I was jealous that I wasn't being included or on the list of potential co-authors. Mm-hmm. And then I was asked to do Freddie's book. And then I was talking with Moolah about doing her book. And I can't remember who intervened, but I think someone said, no, we want you to do Ric Flair's book. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, Ric Flair's book.
Yeah.
And so I did Flair's book, and then Superstar Billy Graham actually called me on the phone and asked if I'd be interested in doing his book. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty exciting.
So let's start back with the Blassie book. Did you sit down and interview, or did he talk into a recorder and you transcribed? Yeah,
well,
how'd that go?
Freddie Blassie was in his 80s at the time, mm-hmm. and he was in failing health. And I can remember having a talk with Linda McMahon about this, because she was aware that Freddie might not have long for this world. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like Freddie wanted to get all of his stories out. And Freddie had these notebooks at home, beautiful handwriting. I mean, the nuns really beat his cursive writing into him. Mm-hmm. It was beautiful handwriting, very legible. And he'd been taking some pretty detailed notes of his career. Mm-hmm. And so he had those, and those prompted his memory. And of course, I did quite a bit of research on him. And because it was a WWE sanctioned project, I had access at least to, because back then it wasn't YouTube, I had access to the WWF archives, and I was able to watch some of his finer moments, at least in WWF. And back then, a lot of people were still alive. This would be around 2002. So I interviewed John Tolis, his arch nemesis in LA. And I interviewed Arnold Skolin and Killer Kowalski. And I interviewed the Fabulous Moolah. And I interviewed Vince McMahon. And, you know, a lot of folks who aren't alive. Michael LaBelle, the promoter in Los Angeles, who had been the promoter for at the Olympic Auditorium. And they all had something to add to it. So I looked at it as a bound documentary. And Freddie Blassie's career went back to the Carney days. And so he went from, it was a bridge from the carnival days, the roots of professional wrestling, to the pay-per-view era. So I viewed it as a historical document and, you know, believe it is.
Did Freddie get a chance to like read the book, or was he kind of too?
He did. He did. He read the book. When he read it, he was concerned about some of the foul language that he himself had used and some of his sex stories. But at that point, WWE was still it was the tail end of the Attitude Era. And I think he was assured by the office, that's fine. It makes you a bigger personality. What I recall about that book was they had a lawyer from Simon & Schuster read the book over to see if, you know, anything was worthy of a lawsuit. And I interviewed Lou Albano also for the book. And the lawyer's like, I'm very concerned about these depictions of Lou Albano. He says, he says he has a screw loose. He goes, you know, I mean, you know, you're accusing Lou Albano of being perhaps mentally ill. And I'm like, have you ever seen Lou Albano perform?
Yeah. I mean, I have to think with all of those type of, like with those type of biographies, the blanket excuse for everything could just be, well, it's kayfabe and we're playing characters, so therefore we're elaborating, you know.
Well, except it wasn't all kayfabe. It was kayfabe, like Blassie was definitely many times in Freddie Blassie mode.
Right.
And when he'd boast, he was God's gift to women. And he'd say, you know, even at 83 years old, I can be on my walking with my cane into the doctor's office and I still get a look. And you should have seen me 50 years ago, you know. And he'd talk about Lou Albano. And I'd say that was a work shoot. Him and Lou Albano loved each other, and they were always having falling outs about one thing or another. So when he was saying Lou Albano's not playing with a full deck and he has a screw loose, I think he kind of believed it, you know, but he also had this great affection for Lou Albano, you know.
I mean, we have friends that we would say that about.
Sure. You know, and then Lou Albano said stuff about him. You know, I mean, those guys had been together a long time.
So walk me through. So you do the Blassie one, and then the next one is Ric Flair, and that was a WWE one too, right?
It was, yes.
Okay, so how do you maneuver? I mean, the bulk of Ric Flair's career is not WWE.
No, it's not. It's not.
And WWE kind of likes to erase things that didn't happen under there. So how do you work around?
Well, they didn't erase things that happened. At that point, this is post 2001. WWE now owns the assets of WCW. It's you know, the NWA exists, but in a very localized regional form. So the NWA is no threat to WWE at this time. And so I was able to tell that story of being the real 60-minute man who had to perform in town after town after town, sometimes twice in the same day, and make the local babyface look like a superstar, but still retain the championship. And always be ready to protect himself in case somebody wanted to double cross him. Mm-hmm. So that's another piece of wrestling history, you know, being that, you know, touring NWA champion in a time when the most, not the most savory characters populated the wrestling business. And once again, I was grateful to have the opportunity to contribute to that history.
Do you remember any stories from Rick when he said, like, there was a couple times he went in the ring when he wasn't sure if the other guy on the other side of the ring was going to go into business for himself?
Not quite that. And Harley Race assured me when I interviewed Harley Race that Rick was a pretty tough guy. Mm-hmm. And Rick could handle himself. That even though Rick pretended to be a dandy, mm-hmm. Rick was a great athlete and as tough as any of them and could handle himself. But there were incidents where the crowds turned on Rick, particularly in the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. He wrestled Jack Veneno. Veneno means poison in Spanish. And Jack Veneno was, you know, an icon, a sports icon in the Dominican Republic. And at one point, the crowd was not only getting hostile, but the soldiers surrounding the ring started to act menacing, and they were armed with automatic weapons. And that's when Ric Flair grabbed Jack Veneno and put him on top of him, mm-hmm. and said, "You're pinning me."
Yeah.
You know? And so ostensibly it appeared that Ric Flair had lost the championship, but he didn't. The crowd was led to believe that in order for Rick to hightail it back to North America.
I mean, that's got to be scary, but also as a wrestler, you got to think, I'm really doing my job because these people hate me. But
right.
They might hate me too much because I might not make it out of here alive.
And I remember Abdullah the Butcher once telling me that in Puerto Rico, where he wrestled quite a bit, you know, he loved being booed. And then suddenly the fans would get quiet. And he said, when they get quiet, it means they're going to riot. Mm-hmm. And there's like a calm before the storm. They all kind of take a collective breath. Mm-hmm. And the riot's about to start. And he's like, that's when you roll out of the ring and leave.
when you were talking to Rick, did you get to sit down with him?
Quite a bit. Yeah. We drove in the car together. We had a tape recorder between us and we'd be driving together.
What is, I'm sure a lot of people are interested in the nature boy in the car, the nature boy that's not, I'm sorry, I should say the Ric Flair when he's not.
Richard Flair.
Yeah, Richard
well,
Flair.
There isn't really much of a difference between Ric Flair and Richard Flair and Ric Flair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he comes from a very interesting background. He was adopted by an agency, the same agency that Joan Crawford's Mommy Dearest Daughter came from. And as it turns out, a lot of these kids were taken from their parents, and the parents thought the children had died like shortly after labor. And a lot of these were like teen mothers in the South. They would sign these documents. They weren't even sure what they were signing. And then these kids were just put on planes and sent to well-to-do families all over the country. Ric Flair's father was a successful gynecologist in the Twin Cities area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I read the paperwork and I read his mother's letter, you know, his adoptive mother's letter to the agency, how desperately she wanted a child. And, you know, he was a great athlete. And, you know, but he was Ric Flair and he was hard to contain, hard to manage. And his parents eventually sent him to a boarding school, which was a school where he thrived in athletics. And then he went to the University of Minnesota to play football, and his roommate was Bill Goldberg's older brother. I think it was from Bill Goldberg's father's first marriage. Huh. He knew Greg Gagne, and Greg Gagne was the one who got him into wrestling. And at one point, Rick just couldn't handle the discipline of training. And I guess Vern Gagne, you're realizing how much potential Rick had, went to the house where Rick was living and just dragged them outside onto the lawn and, you know, gave them these hard lessons about, hey, man, you know, you're doing this because, you know, you have the potential, but, you know, if you give this up, you will be a loser for life, essentially something like that. Mm-hmm. So there were some good tales there that predated him becoming the Nature Boy.
And was Rick happy with his final work, the autobiography?
I'm not so sure. One of the problems was that Rick did not request me to be his author. Simon & Schuster and WWE requested that I be his author. So, you know, there was, it was sometimes a challenging, there was some challenging interactions between us. Mm-hmm. At the end of the project, we spoke very kindly to one another. I wish I'd been able to stay friends with him. You know, like everyone else I've co-authored a book with, we usually have become friends for life. Mm-hmm. I particularly would have enjoyed, not enjoyed, but I would have been gratified to say some comforting words to him after his son Reed died, mm-hmm. because I heard him on the phone speaking to Reed, and he was a very loving father. And I think I even learned some lessons about parenting, believe it or not, from listening to the loving way Rick spoke to his children. So I would have liked to have, you know, said that to Rick in person, and who knows, hopefully I will one day.
Well, I hope you get the chance. I mean, if we learned anything about wrestling, you know, any burned bridge can be repaired.
I wouldn't say it's a burned bridge, but okay. We didn't become as close as I would have liked to.
Right. Did you stay close with Superstar Billy Graham?
Yes, I did.
And how did that experience go?
That was great. I mean, and Superstar Billy Graham really wanted me to be his co-author. He knew me from before. And, you know, we would talk about lots of things besides wrestling. And I can remember there was one day when he and I went for Mexican food, mm-hmm. in Phoenix. And there was a really attractive waitress who was serving us. And he's saying, I'm the former WWE World Heavyweight Champion, and this is my co-author. And she's looking at us like, you know, you amateurs, like, I'm going to believe that. And he and I both knew, uh-huh. that she thought that, and we were just howling with laughter because of her cynicism.
I mean, do that many people try to pass himself off as Superstar Billy Graham?
No, but I'm sure, you know, being an attractive woman working in a restaurant, yeah. she hears a lot of people boasting about various things.
Yeah. What if she was like, oh, a writer? What if she completely
ignored him? That didn't
happen. As a writer, I know that doesn't happen. So you get done writing all the biographies, you go and do a bunch of other books. Eventually you come across, you start doing your latest book, which just came out in September, and it's Too Sweet, Inside the Indie Wrestling Revolution. So how did that, was that your idea? How did that?
That was my idea completely. And look, you know, I was on retainer with WWE until 2007. Mm-hmm. Now I've periodically done other projects for them. You know, there was never a falling out with WWE, and I've also covered events for different you know, publications, and I've had press access you know, through WWE. So there's always been a warm relationship with WWE. In fact, I co-wrote the WWE Encyclopedia of Sports Entertainment, the third edition, in 2016. And just recently, the fourth edition came out. And I was surprised, happily surprised, that WWE gave me a co-writer's credit again, because they used some of the passages I wrote. So that's the relationship I have with WWE. At the same time, I couldn't wait for WWE to gift me another project, because I'm a working writer, mm-hmm. and I need to, you know, generate my own projects. Mm-hmm. And so when I was at WrestleMania 34, I was walking around the Bourbon Street area after, you know, during that weekend in New Orleans, and I noticed a lot of Bullet Club shirts. And I thought, well, that's an interesting phenomena, because the Bullet Club were not part of WWE. I never saw NWO shirts when at WrestleMania weekend, when the NWO was really hot in WCW. And when I spoke to the executive editor, Michael Holmes, after that weekend, he had also been in New Orleans and he noticed the same thing. And I said, I think the time is right for us to do a book on the indie wrestling revolution. And, you know, I didn't get much resistance. He agreed with me. And so that's when I started the project.
So for the casual fan out there, or for the people who just, there's different definitions. Like, let's talk about what exactly encompasses indie wrestling. What makes a promotion indie?
Well, I addressed that very early in the book. And for the purposes of the book, I said, I'm going to define indie in its widest sense, which is other than WWE. Now, realize AEW was brand new at the time, but to this day, AEW is a direct extension of the indies. You know, you had Eddie Kingston in a main event recently.
Right.
You know, that is, you know, an indie icon. You know, you look at, while I was researching the book, you know, I'd see Darby Allin on different shows. You know, the book ends with a GCW show, a Game Changer Wrestling show in Asbury Park the night before the first AEW Dynamite taping. And on that show, from that show, Jungle Boy, Marco Stunt, Orange Cassidy, Joey Janela, and referee Bryce Remsburg depart and head down to the first AEW Dynamite taping. So I would say in that book, anything other than WWE is indie, but I include everything from a small promotion in Idaho to New Japan. It's a very wide umbrella.
If you had to take an educated guess, like how many indie promotions are there?
I couldn't even guess, because, you know, I'm researching a sequel now. And, you know, you know, this is more about professional wrestling in the time of the coronavirus. And, you know, I've been going online and I found a promotion in Arkansas. And I'm like, these guys are holding shows. And it's like the arena is next door to the owner's garage. And they're just like local guys who get in the ring, I think, every single Friday night and put on a wrestling show. So, you know, those groups don't necessarily get much publicity. So, you know, there's a lot of indie wrestling going on. And if you're using, you know, the widest definition, who knows? I can't even guess.
I mean, the effects of COVID on indie wrestling are obvious. Like, you know, a lot of promotions had to shut down. But do you think there's any positives that can be taken from what happened, or anything, you know, moving forward? How does COVID change indie wrestling?
Well, you know, I just had this chat with a friend of mine a couple of days ago. And, you know, right now the rumor is that WWE will change its touring schedule, will go to a scaled back degree of touring, which means a lot of places are not going to get their WWE house shows if that plan is actually enacted. If that's the case, it opens up the market for local indie wrestling. And, you know, maybe people in a certain part of the country or the world begin to follow a small indie, and those are their wrestlers, except for the once a year or once every 2 or 3 years when WWE rolls through there.
Yeah, I got to feel like, especially with the WWE not doing shows, or not doing house shows anymore. One of the things that they used to do, which always kind of like surprised me, but then the more I thought about it, the more I got it. You know, two rival promotions would never run shows near each other. But when the WWE had a big show, especially something like WrestleMania, indie shows would run all around it, because there's a majority of wrestling fans in one populated area who they're only going to get this wrestling on Sunday, but Friday, Saturday, Monday, they can go see other stuff.
Yeah, Mike Johnson from PW Insider, when he interviewed me about this book, he refers to those other promotions as the barnacles on the boat. and that's a phenomena WWE never could have anticipated, that WrestleMania would become such a destination that all these other promotions would decide, let's converge on the same part of the country and, showcase our own talent. Mm. But it is a real phenomenon now, and it's very much a part of the book I wrote, because, and it's a part of the sequel too, about wrestling during the time of the coronavirus, because all of these indie wrestlers, WrestleMania week is the time they get the maximum visibility. Mm-hmm. You have fans from all over the world who are there for WrestleMania. And if you're a guy who's mainly a West Coast wrestler or a British Midlands wrestler, you're on a card and everyone's seeing you and everybody's hearing about you. Also, you can work 9 times over the course of a weekend and make quite a bit of money and meet promoters, make contacts, widen your social media presence. So for WrestleMania and all the related events to be canceled this year, really, it was quite detrimental to a lot of these folks.
Yeah, I'm hoping they can get back on track with it. I mean, do you ever think you could see a scenario, if things get back up and running, the bigger indie promotions going sort of the NWA route, where it's almost like one champion, 7-8?
Look, you have Ring of Honor, and Ring of Honor has a relationship with the NWA. They've used Nick Aldis on their shows. We see AEW using Serena Deeb, the NWA Women's Champion, on their shows. And prior to that, Thunder Rosa was on their shows. You have the relationship with Ring of Honor and New Japan, and the relationship with the NWA. So there's always that possibility. But you also have people who are protecting their own company's interests first. Right. So I don't know if we'll see that or not. Right. Maybe if there is a scaled down touring schedule, it won't hurt, everybody. Right. It remains to be seen.
If you were giving your book to the casual wrestling fan and you had to take one part and say, if you're going to read anything, read this part, what would that be?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about that. It depends on the sensibility of the fan. I describe, if you have more of an underground sensibility, I describe little promotions that were put together by teenagers. Mm-hmm. One guy, David Fuller in Texas, he was like 15 or 16 when he promoted his first show in his friend's backyard. Mm-hmm. And a guy gave him a ring and he just left it there. They rented the ring. He goes, I have no place to put it. You guys keep it. And he said, when you go to a major show, they'd say, don't throw anything at the ring. And he would say, do whatever you want. So, there's some great Ring of Honor stories about how Ring of Honor almost fizzled out before it exploded, because the original owner was accused of, the original co-owner was accused of some sexual improprieties. And then Carrie Silkin, who ended up purchasing the company, had to overcome that and managed to do it by putting, I believe it was Samoa Joe and CM Punk and, guys of that caliber in the ring and just getting fans so turned on. Mm-hmm. The Game Changer Wrestling and all the shows that they put on, and they every year they do Joey Janela's Spring Break, and they have a 60-person match called the World's Greatest Clusterfuck Battle Royal. And that's a very entertaining section. And then we have the origins of AEW. So there's a lot in there. And we go back in time and describe the outlaw promotions of the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to think there's something for, you know, every wrestling fan sensibility.
So what you're telling me is the person should read the entire book is what you're telling me.
Yes. And I know it's not a fast read either, because there's a lot of detail to digest. You know, some people have said to me, oh, I read the book, you know, I read the book in a night. And other people have said to me, hey, it took me a couple of weeks to get through it, because, you know, there's a lot of different stories and it is history. And so, but yes, I would say read the whole book, and that will give you the wide spectrum of indie wrestling that I try to portray.
As a writer, how do you react to someone saying they read the book in a night? Is that a compliment? Is that a, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's a compliment that I was so turned on that I just kept reading and I couldn't put it down. Okay. But I don't expect everyone to read it in a night.
Yeah, I'm not that fast of a reader. I'm going to take some time with it.
Generally, I like to take time too.
They probably remember nothing. Like, they might remember like the last 10 pages that they read, but I can't imagine they remember. I don't know.
I remember reading Mick Foley's book very quickly. You know, probably it was more like a week, but remembering it pretty vividly. And then like a year later, reading it again.
Okay. So on that note, a two-part question for you. Can you tell me a biography that you read and you were like, damn, I wish I wrote that? And
well, I couldn't say that about Mick Foley's book since he wrote it himself.
Right. But I'm saying any wrestler that you read, even someone who wrote their own, that you were kind of like, I wish I could have put a different spin on that, or I wish I was the ghostwriter or co-author on that.
You know, well, Foley's book is great. And it maybe is my favorite pro wrestling autobiography ever, because Mick Foley happens to be a very talented writer. I loved Chris Jericho's first book about his pre-WWE days. You know, Bret Hart's book was really riveting. So there's a lot of those books, you know, the Andre the Giant book that I just read, that was written by Pat LaPrade and Bertrand Hebert. I mean, there's so much detail, and they dispel all these myths, some of which were perpetuated by Andre. So, you know, yeah, I certainly felt envious that they were able to take the time to do that much exhaustive research and write the definitive story of Andre the Giant.
And who's the person, living or dead, that you're like, that's the one, that would be my end all, the greatest one?
I don't know if there's anybody end all, but certainly Vince McMahon.
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't think that's ever going to happen.
You never know.
I mean, he's letting him do the biography series on him. So he's getting a little bit more open to things.
Yeah. I wonder what level of cooperation there is. I'd also heard about an oral history that was taking place of the WWE. You know, once I read the final versions of those, I'll conclude whether those were successful endeavors or not.
And before I let you go, I always take to people's Wikipedia page and I try and like find out, split fact from fiction. There's one part that jumped out at me that I hope is true, and I want to ask you about. Did you actually once write an autobiography about the Iron Sheik that never got published?
Yes. Not only
Did you know I was going to ask that?
No. Okay. It comes up in every interview.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. In fact, I wrote two versions of it. Mm-hmm. I wrote one version for Simon & Schuster. And at that point, he still had a drug problem. Mm-hmm. And the conclusion was it wasn't a very redeeming story. Mm-hmm. And then a few years, and I remained close. That's another guy I stayed close with him and his family. And because you bond, you know, you open up. There's a lot more to the Iron Sheik than the character you saw on TV. Yeah. And then I did another story for Playboy magazine a few years later on a weekend with the Iron Sheik. And I went through his history and I mentioned that he was now drug free. And, by now, ECW Press had a relationship with WWE, and they said, redo the book. And I redid the book, and I had the redeeming parts added in. And I guess there were some folks high up at WWE who just felt all these crazy drug stories and profanity didn't help their brand and decided not to publish the book. So I was paid twice to write this book. I can't really complain, but because of my new book, Too Sweet, Inside the Indie Wrestling Revolution, fans have been contacting me. And I just spoke to a fan the other day who said prior to the ECW press book being published, there were actually review copies sent out, which I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And so he had paid $250 for one of those review copies. Mm-hmm. And he said that he went online and he saw another version was selling for $2,500.
Wow.
So I didn't know that till the other day. So I guess there are some people who are passing that book around.
Well, here's what else jumped out at me. Not just that you did the biography, but this actually, I copy and pasted it. This on your Wikipedia page, it says, those who read it have called the book the greatest unpublished treasure in wrestling journalism.
I would say that's accurate.
Yeah, why not?
I use that term in this book. I discuss it in Too Sweet Inside the Indie Wrestling Revolution. Uh-huh. And I do say it's the greatest unpublished treasure in wrestling journalism. And then I add, and that's not a work, it's a shoot.
That's funny. Keith, thank you so much for being on. I really enjoyed this. I'd love to have you on again to talk about.
I'd like to be on again.
Any projects, anything you want, and we'll have you on and we'll talk again soon.
Good. It's my pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks so much.
And that brings another episode of Not About Wrestling to a close. Guests of the Not About Wrestling show stay in their own damn houses. If you like the show, please share it on social or leave a review on iTunes. And remember to subscribe to Not About Wrestling on YouTube. Just go to youtube.com/brobible and find the Not About Wrestling section. Thanks again for listening or watching. And see you all next week. Well, I won't see you at all. You know what I mean.